The Postmodern Mix. In this last chapter, I shall elucidate how the Oedipus and Narcissus sagas hang together, and how this hanging together has given the intrinsic taste to today's postmodern consumer culture, which I call synonymously Oedipal culture, hero culture, paranoid culture, para culture, incest culture, rape culture, murder culture, or abuse-centered culture. I shall focus in this analysis especially on how the violent impulse comes up to abduct, sexually penetrate, and murder young children, and how it is related to both the Oedipal and narcissistic fixations playing in sync, which then gives the special postmodern mix of violent moralism. This problem has never been understood in Western psychiatry. In Jürgen Bart's case, even today, German psychiatric authorities exhibit the nonsensical theory of Bart having been at the same time a pedophile, pederast, and homosexual, which is about as saying that a cauliflower is composed of a tree, an apple, and a pear. As long as Western psychology, psychiatry, and sexology do not recognize the primacy of the emotional etiology before jumping to look for the culprit in the sexual setup of the person, nothing will be understood here, not even in the future. I have drafted an approach to healing sexual sadism that focuses on a bioenergetic view and that acknowledges that in every sexual attraction, the prime motivating force is emotional and not sexual in the first place. It is this emotional predilection that in some cases becomes sexualized or charged with sexual energy. Thus, when I want to understand sadism and violent sex crime that is an expression of this sadism, I must focus on the emotional setup of the person, if emotions are flowing or if the emotional flow is blocked. In fact, sadism can only be understood when the fact is seen that emotions, as a condensation of élan vital or emonic energy, naturally flow in the healthy organism and are changing in a kaleidoscopic way, and that every blockage of the emonic flow brings about a violent outburst because the energy will free its way to full discharge. If the latter is also prohibited by the person's superego, the person will not be a sadist but develop a cancer or heart disease. I shall develop further along the lines of the Narcissus legend and ask a few questions. According to the myth, Narcissus fell in love with his own self-image. Was he never loved by anyone, or why did he feel such an urge to fall in love, an urge so strong that in absence of any tangible other love object he chose himself? Since his childhood, his beauty had been admired by everyone. Narcissus himself, however, who has never seen himself in the mirror, was unaware of his identity. One day when he walked at the border of a lake, which was a virgin lake, as no animal had ever drunk from it, and no tree ever plunged its branches in it, and no human had ever seen it. Here, the youngster felt a sudden fatigue. He sat down at the lake and bowed over the water for drinking, and for the first time he saw his double. Fallen in love with himself, the myth says, he spent hours in melancholy and in regretting that he would never be able to possess his twin sister, which was his living self-image. Eventually, concludes the tale, Narcissus could not stand the agony of this impossible love anymore and ran a knife in his heart, bursting out in, "Farewell, beautiful love that has no hope." And on the place where his blood fell on the ground, white Narcissi grew that had red hearts. This for the legend. On first sight, one may think that this is a story about vanity. But in reality, the legend stands for the discovery of identity. What is identity? Identity can be defined operationally, as it's very difficult to give an overall definition to it, as difficult as it is to define love. Functionally speaking, identity is characterized by the fact that all what we discover in another, we must have discovered in ourselves first. And the end result of this self-discovery is identity. This means that we cannot perceive the qualities of another if and as long as we ignore our own. Narcissus' apparent egocentrism is truly the first step and a necessary one in the discovery of his self, which is catalyzed by the discovery why he is lovable. Self-love is the condition for our capacity to love others. This psychological insight must be put in relation to education and the child's relationship with the mother. It is not haphazard that in the legend, the mother did all kinds of precautions to avoid the child discovering himself in a mirror. Such as Narcissus' mother are all mothers who have never time and attention for their child. The mother is the mirror of the child's ego. The ego can develop only in a child whose mother is able and willing to mirror him or her. A narcissistic mother cannot do that. This is why children who have narcissistic mothers, also called witch mothers, do not know who they are, and their ego development is deficient. Such kind of mothers search in their children what they, when they were young, searched in their parents. They try to mirror themselves in their children, thereby changing the roles and the rules, in that they burden the child with an ability a child cannot have, to be a parent for their own mother. This results in the child as an adult having in turn a deficient ego. As it is already obvious after this short explanation, narcissism is by definition generational, a family curse, to use the old term. This problem of narcissism becomes especially stringent with single mothers who got a single male child, and when the father of the child is absent forever or most of the time. Here then, as I have shortly explained earlier in this study, the Oedipal hang-up comes in and becomes intelligible in this constellation. When the boy can namely not identify with his father during the Oedipal phase, the boy will develop an Oedipal fixation. This means the boy will cling to his mother in an unhealthy and neurotic manner that will negatively infringe upon his emotional and psychosexual development. In the legend, Oedipus killed his father and married his mother. He, however, did this unconsciously, for he ignored his parents. The tragedy was triggered by the father, not the son. If we say it was fate, and only fate, we in last resort deny responsibility. An Oedipal fixation becomes a problem for a little boy, especially in case the mother is a homesitter, a woman who has abandoned any hope to find a viable partner, and thus projects her erotic wishes, while most often unconsciously, on her son. This may be expressed in erotically seductive behavior, but in most cases, this kind of women are actually erotically blocked on a conscious level. The problem here is that the boy won't leave the home in search of a partner, and that the constant emotional demands of the mother trap the boy in a codependent partner relation where he becomes the ersatz for the partner the mother denies herself to find. The fact that such a relation remains platonic is really insignificant compared to the importance of another element, the lack of autonomy for the boy. In this constellation, the boy striving for autonomy either faces explicit demands of the mother to stay close to her, or is charged with guilt feelings and a growing rationalization of the situation that will be expressed by the boy in the wish to protect the mother, to save the mother from any harm she suffered previously with men. Typically, in this entanglement situation, the mother tells her son in all length and width the misfortunes she suffered in her love life, thereby invoking in him a self-defeating judgment about himself, his own maleness. This negative judgment of the male can be coarsely expressed in the thought, all men are swines. In my own case of mother-son codependence, all this was aggravated further through the fact that my mother put me in homes where I was cruelly mistreated without caring too much about the violence inflicted upon me on a daily level. This resulted in a particularly strong contradiction between the life I was leading during the week in the home and the life I was supposed to live with her during the weekend. And it gave her a very good basis for justifying her overprotectiveness and the home sweet home philosophy she spun around it. I had to be compensated, she reasoned, for the bad home in having a nice weekend with her, and she would, as always, be very generous with me, and it was this so-called generosity that she always forwarded as a shield in situations of conflict when I namely wanted to have greater autonomy. I was not unconscious of this sordid entanglement, and here I certainly differed from other youngsters in that I was actually so conscious about it that I actively wished to break out of it and repeatedly thought of running away from home. I was often furious against my mother and had a strong sense of the injustice she was doing to me, but I could not express this anger other than by thinking of myself being ein böser Junge, a bad boy. Later on in life, when I was already married, actually not so much later as I married young, I reproached my mother to have overprotected me in a way to keep me away from life, thereby invalidating my striving for autonomy and my quest to make love experiences with girls and thus outside home and school. Her answer in that and other very similar situations was one of furiously and viciously attacking me as an ungrateful nerd who was just like his father and uncles, while she had sacrificed herself always so that I could have a decent life, because if I had been under the tutelary authority of my father, I would have run the streets to find food. That she regretted the bad experiences I made in the homes, but that she had always been very generous with me, much more generous than any other parent for compensating me a little for the hurt suffered in those homes. When I asked her at 18 to study in Paris, she replied she was not going to finance my interest for luxury and that if I wanted to study there, I should find my money in the street. So I stayed and studied in my hometown. Similarly, for the subject to study, I preferred to become a musical teacher or recording engineer, but she insisted law was the best for me to study. I gave in while I knew that I had a passion for music and for children and would have to force myself into law, which I did for the next 20 years. Typically, emotional incest does not imply a sexual interaction between parent and child. In the contrary, will the mother carefully avoid touching the boy? And it's this avoidance of touch, much more than anything, that rings the alarm bell in the boy's unconscious. Why does my mother never touch me? He reasons, and correctly so. Why do these mothers never touch their boys? I thus ask again, as in the question is the answer. Emotional abuse is so much ingrained in patriarchal culture, and the role of the mother-saving Oedipal hero is so common in our culture that most people never even once reflect about the perversity of such a family constellation. Easy body touch is not something fostered in this kind of milieu. In the contrary, it is something fostered in healthy families where parents have a functional sex life. It is the conflict between the never talked about and repressed and the prudishness that results from this repression on one hand, and the open or implicit possessiveness of the symbiotoholic parent on the other, that triggers in the child an unconscious sexual response for the parent. The for the most people uncomfortable truth is that if the incest had been acted out sexually, the psychic tension at the root of the codependence would have been released and no Oedipal fixation would result from it. Men have been outspoken who had consenting intercourse with their mothers, and the astonishing result was that they had the most fulfilling sex life with adult females later on in life, and that often in these constellations, the future wife will have an excellent relationship with the first woman the boy enjoyed sexually, his mother. It is emotional incest that really creates havoc in a boy's psyche, because his biological male identity is gravely impaired through the exclusiveness of his relation with mother. And guilt and shame is the result of it, because the boy knows that he should rather look around for a girl of his age or even an older woman, but that it's time to leave his mother and his nest behind. I see here in this attitude of narcissistic mothers toward their boys the real core of the problem of emotional abuse, because it creates a flagrant contradiction. When the boy wants to go out and look around for friends or a girlfriend, the mother will tend to keep him away from life, arguing he was still too young and inexperienced to just go on his own, that there are dangers involved in such a quest or perverse strangers waiting to get him around the corner. But when it goes to care for mother because she is sick or depressed or had a bad day, then boy is big enough to play the gigolo and be around mother and at her feet for any service she may need, and boy is big enough then to understand when mother talks about her past and her bad experiences with men. This contradiction creates rage in the boy, because he sees that the mother just uses him for her purposes and plays power games with him. From a bioenergetic point of view, it has to be seen that the Oedipal conflict is traumatic for the child because of the denial of sexual fulfillment it implies, while it triggers so much longing in the child. It's a real torture for the child, a real trauma. And it has been admitted by psychoanalyst Françoise Dolto that in most cases children lose their pre-Oedipal memory, which only confirms my assumption that it's a real trauma, as it results in amnesia. In her book La Cause des Enfants, Dr. Dolto writes, I quote, "Memory in adults erases all that belongs to the pre-Oedipal period. That is why our society has so much difficulty to accept infantile sexuality. In past centuries, there were the nurses who knew it. Parents, however, ignored it." End of quote. Freud namely found that amnesia, the loss of memory prior to the trauma-triggering situation, is in most cases a direct indicator for trauma having occurred. Hence, Freud concluded, when we find childhood amnesia in a patient, this can be taken as direct evidence for the etiology of trauma to be affirmed for that situation in question. This is, in my view, the reason for the strong aggressiveness toward the parent of the same sex in the Oedipal situation. It's a visceral reaction of the biosystem that comes from sensual and sexual deprivation, and that is caused by the exclusiveness of the parent-child relation in general and parental and societal prohibition of children having sex with peers in particular. Children need and want a sex life much like adults, while the sexual acts children perform or attempt to perform may be of a lesser complete nature, but this difference does not alter the psychosexual importance of childhood sexuality. when, as in our culture, children are prohibited from engaging in sexually explicit and healthy peer relations or relations with adults other than their parents, they will be trapped, if they want or not, in a gerontophilic attraction toward their parents. This cultural setup, that is obviously against nature, results in the triangular relationship between parents and one or two children that is so typical for the modern urban family. In this strongly exclusive and triangular relationship, the child is coerced into an ambiguous love-hate relation with their parents. What fuels the child's aggressiveness toward the parent of the same sex is not, as Freud supposed, a situation of rivalry for the single available sex partner, often coined metaphorically as two men desire one woman or two girls desire one man, but more generally a rage to have been denied the vast realm of potential sex partners of same or different age outside of the family. And the aggressiveness, therefore, of the child is not exclusively directed against the parent of the same sex, but against both parents, while it has to be noted that the child's organism will not allow the child to gain consciousness of this rage because of survival reasons. The child's cognitive apparatus will build a justification factor that leads to the child's reasoning on the lines of, well, I'm supposed to love my parents and be exclusively loved by my parents, as society does not allow me to love other people and does not allow other people to love me in the same way as my parents love me. Society says it's dangerous for me, as other people may want to abduct and kill me, as they cannot love me in the same pure manner as my parents do. Here is where the whole system of lies and betrayal starts to distort the perception and cognitive grasp of love by the consumer child, in this bias that society puts up and that is strongly fools through its abysmally violent anti-pedophilia debate. And what it leads to is that because children cannot, for survival reasons, express the rage against their parents and society, they will turn this rage against themselves and become narcissistic and autodestructive, if not schizophrenic. Even children who do not develop a pathology will remain with strong guilt feelings, often all their life through, regarding sexuality and all forms of erotic love. I guess Freud's reasoning here is true insofar as when the parent of the opposite sex is present, the child can project some of the aggressiveness upon the parent of the same sex. But here, contrary to Freud, I assume that because of survival reasons, this acting out of aggressiveness toward the parent of the same sex, for example, through straight talk or by hitting the parent, is such perilous an action for a child that this will be done only when he or she can be sure of the support and unconditional love of the parent of the opposite sex. This is a precarious situation for a child in any kind of family, and I believe that generally Freud's reasoning here was quite theoretical. As a general rule, children do keep true to respecting their parents, even to a point of self-denial, except the minority of children who incarnate with a very strong ego and character. I have indeed observed that the number of children of the latter vintage is growing over the last decades, but at the same time, the situation of the child in consumer culture has become more and more tough and alienating, to a point that children are today as much under state control and supervision as nuclear weapons, foreign embassies, top secret material, and spies. This is a potential route for more domestic violence, because to enclose children in homes and schools that function pretty much like prisons is not what a caring state will do if it loves its children. This is a major social and political pathology we are facing, if we can face it at all. In my experience, most people in most Western cultures blind these facts simply out of their consciousness interface, and this because of sheer fright of the consequences of any vital action to the contrary. Freud's cultural bias is notorious, and I will not need to write pages about that, as it has not only been analyzed in modern biographies and recent psychoanalytic literature, but it was the true reason for the clash between Freud and Reich, Freud and Jung, Freud and Adler, and Freud and Fromm. The clashes were, of course, personally tinted, and in every case, there was a personal drama behind the scenes. What is significant, however, and common to all of these deep relationships is that none of them was solved peacefully. This already is a hint as to the unruly nature of Freud's authoritarianism. And the material speaks for itself, as we have really a large body of evidence. The clash between Reich and Freud was particularly revealing, and Freud's cultural bias for one time was explicit and coined into the dictum culture primes. Freud rejected Reich's activism for child sexual rights, despite the fact that it was he himself, Freud, who had for the first time in Western social history openly declared that the human child is sexual from birth. Freud reasoned that the psychiatric profession had to accept the basic setup of society, including its denial of the sexual rights of the child, and that the psychiatrist and psychoanalyst had to cure the psychic malformations resulting from the cultural distortion of the natural sexual function, but not more. They had to restrain from any social activism, because otherwise, as Freud thought, society would be thrown into chaos. The Oedipal situation, as I coin in one term, the whole of the emotional, tactile, sensual and sexual deprivation of the child in modern consumer culture, is a real trauma. It creates havoc in the child's psyche, and one of the undesired results of this pathology is that it leads to a link between sexual desire, aggressive rage and fear, which can lead to sexual deviations later in life. Typical for these deviations is namely that the person can discharge sexually only if acts of sadism are inflicted upon the mate, or conversely, the masochistic suffering of acts of sadism is experienced during the mating game. When adult males project their unconscious Oedipal mother imago on little girls, they may experience emotional and sexual attraction for them, but they also may at times experience the same rage they felt toward their mothers, but that they repressed. This repressed rage then may become sexually charged. This may or not, depending on the level of consciousness of the person, lead to a violent urge to punish little girls by beating them up and or by forcing oral, anal or vaginal intercourse on them, or by abducting them for this purpose. It has since long been established by psychiatry that these urges, be they acted out or not, have their origin in a non-resolved Oedipus complex. The person will have greater control of his affliction if he does not fight it, but tries to understand his behavior and his emotional confusion. And here we see again the difference in behavior between the true hero and the Oedipal hero. The true hero will first of all acknowledge the desire, be it hard to accept and hard to live with and cope with, even if the desire is so virulent that it can never be acted out without actually hurting and harming the child physically or emotionally. This is, to repeat it, not the case with a pure sexual attraction, as in that case a way can be found in most circumstances to upreact sexually without actual penetration, but only in the aggravating case that the desire is charged with violence in such a way that penetration is needed to come off, and even worse, that the child has to be beaten, made suffer and cry and give signs of expressing the pain, typically by screaming, for the sadist being able to discharge orgasmically. It goes without saying that for any child, whatever their age, and even an adult, the latter experience is not a particularly nice one, while a tender sexual encounter with an adult without penetration may go along with a child, even a completely innocent boy or girl, if only there is no pain, no violence, and no threat, and most importantly, no coercion. The problem is that most Oedipal heroes, in one way or the other, suffer from sexual sadism. As a simple result of the rage they repressed when they repeatedly wanted to build autonomy and were held back by their possessive and narcissistic mothers. While society has developed in recent years quite a permissive attitude toward sadomasochism when it occurs between consenting adults, this form of sexuality remains highly problematic when an adult traps a child into his personal sadistic affliction, and perhaps by expecting the child to be masochistic by nature in order to justify the offense. In my draft statute on physical and sexual violence against children, I have subsumed sexual sadism under the header sexual violence, but I have decriminalized all sexual activity in this draft bill and came up with a completely new approach, which is focused not upon retaliation, but upon helping the adult transform his violent behavior pattern through a form of emotional and sexual consultancy that is professional, discreet, and effective, and that works for governments as a trusted resource provider. Whatever one may think in this respect, it can hardly be denied that our society must show more responsibility in working out future social and legal policies on the subject of sexual violence against children. As the present situation is hardly satisfying, as it only focuses upon enforcing time and again criminal punishments, which has never been an effective social policy, one may begin to reason on the lines of this present study and look at how the situation of the Oedipal hero could be cognitively grasped and understood, and how, as a result of these insights, methods could be developed to help the afflicted man to grow beyond their fixation. In this endeavor, one focus should certainly be to help the individual to accept to be loved, to be touched, to be kissed and fondled, to begin contemplating himself in a mirror while experiencing feelings of power, self-love, admiration, and healthy self-pride. A very important element of the therapy would be to dissolve the muscular and characterological armor, and this by suggesting the person to experience sexual intercourse with a young woman in a loving and tender way, while the focus should be on enjoying the hot and melting energy flow as it streams through the body once the armor has been dissolved. My research showed me that no coercion can help with sexual sadism, but only tolerance, and again tolerance. And teaching the person actually to be tolerant with himself. Tolerance means patience, first of all, as any progress will be incremental and rather slow in the beginning. With dissolving the character armor, the entire belief system of the Oedipal hero will bit by bit fall in ashes. And when the mind is enlarged, the body will decrease in size as a matter of inverse proportionality. I mean that any pattern of obsessive bodybuilding, obesity, heavy drinking, or chain smoking will vanish by itself once the armor begins to fall apart. On the other hand, I am not in the rings of those who believe that curing the symptoms will do the job, which is why I am firmly opposed to any kind of quick fixes in this respect, while I am of course conscious that the market abounds of such booklets and devices for obvious mercantile reasons. But only a holistic and inside-out approach can do it. Sadism is not easy to heal. And in mainstream psychiatry's view, sadistic child sexual offenders, rapists and killers are still today declared incurable. As a lawyer, I have, of course, notions of forensic psychiatry and have followed these topics up and deepened my knowledge here since about 20 years. As a result, I have written various studies that oppose the outdated and dogmatic view of forensic psychiatry and that show new ways in assessing, formulating, and tackling the problems of violence and abuse in our society. In these books, I have referenced recent approaches to healing that were unknown in our culture still a decade ago and presented a range of healing methods that could possibly be used for healing the sadistic affliction. These publications, some of which I already mentioned in the footnotes, are 8 Dynamic Patterns of Living, Base Elements of True Civilization, Emotional Flow, A Holistic Approach to Healing Sadism, Love and Morality, A Study on the Roots of Violence, Power or Depression, The Cultural Roots of Abuse, Sane Child versus Insane Society, Some Thoughts on Education, The Lunar Bull, Spiritual Significance of Matriarchy, Love and Abuse Toolkit, Healing Early Trauma and Developing Emotional Sanity, The Psychological Revolution, On the Teaching of Krishnamurti, and The Science of Emonics, Systemic Analysis of Emotional Identity in the Etiology of Sexual Paraphilias.